This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Zimbabwean security forces say order has been restored and they will be returning to the streets. But that announcement was met with fear from many Zimbabweans, who remain wary of men in uniform following years of abuses.
And that was VOA's Anita Powell reporting. We'll have the latest from Zimbabwe coming up.
Also, a South Sudanese study in Zimbabwe gives his perspective of the recent developments in the country. And a new research shows that overwhelming majority of sexual violence against teens in the DRC's conflict zones happens in the home and in personal relationships.
We'll have these stories and more for you ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Zimbabwean security forces say order has been restored and they will be returning to the streets. But that announcement was met with fear from many Zimbabweans who remain wary of men in uniform following years of abuses. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Harare.
These are words that should calm and reassure.
The situation in our country has returned to normalcy. We wish, therefore, to advise the nation that the Zimbabwe Republic Police is now assuming its role as stipulated in the Constitution of Zimbabwe under Section 219.
That is police spokeswoman Charity Chiramba announcing police would return to their beats and conduct joint patrols with soldiers in central Harare, less than a week after soldiers took over security duties during the political upheaval that forced President Robert Mugabe to resign. But in Zimbabwe, where human rights groups have accused the police of shocking brutality, arbitrary arrests, and extortion, these words bring little comfort. Police are so unpopular that the stadium of more than 60,000 people booed loudly when the nation's police commissioner last week pledged loyalty to new President Emmerson Mnangagwa during his inauguration. Activist Promise Mokonazi says he has lost count of the number of times he has been arrested. Maybe 20, he says. Many have been in the course of protesting against Mugabe. But also, like many Hararians, he has run across many illegal police roadblocks. Here is his account of an incident a year ago.
Then suddenly there were police officers who just emerged and they sort of manhandled me and took me to some secluded place where they tried to say, can you just pay a bribe and you go? To which I flatly refused and said, no, I don't want, you have to take me to the police station if I'm under arrest. And so they took me to a police station, to Harare Central Police.
There he learned he had been charged with a litany of offenses, from resisting arrest to insulting the president, which is illegal in Zimbabwe. The case was eventually dismissed. Jacob Mufume of the People's Democratic Party told VOA the police force's behavior going forward could improve or undermine the legitimacy of the new government.
You say police are going to behave normally. We get alarm bells because they've been behaving outside the bounds of the law. We need a transformation, a change to the observance of the law, treating civilians with dignity, doing their duties without corruption, not asking to be paid for doing their work, and behaving like we are in a democratic society.
Police spokeswoman Chiramba would not take questions. When VOA asked her how police would attempt to regain the trust of Zimbabweans, she smiled and did not answer. Anita Powell, VOA News, Harare.
A South Sudanese student who was among the crowds who took to the streets to celebrate and witness history in the making when longtime leader Robert Mugabe resigned has a word of warning for Zimbabweans. Ganiko Bangoye Michael, who is a student studying at Harare Institute of Technology, says Zimbabweans should take a lesson from South Sudan and remember that the real work of nation building lies ahead, and they should not be clouded by the current sense of euphoria. He spoke with South Sudan in Focus reporter Ayen Bior.
I could feel the joy in the people. Everyone was happy, and you could actually see that people were really waiting for that moment, because once the news broke, I was moving in a certain car, but what happened is that even the people whom I was with in the car, I could just see how happy they were, screaming. Everyone came out of the house, went to the streets, and they were jubilating. I think it was really a historical day for them. They were really very happy.
Have you ever witnessed anything quite like this?
Yeah, I witnessed it back in South Sudan when we got our independence, 2011. We are also screaming that way. We are happy and everything was just like it was a new beginning. So to them, it's just like a new beginning, like how I witnessed it back in 2011.
It's remarkable you've been able to witness firsthand two historical events on the continent.
Yeah. I think it's an opportunity for me to witness this, because you never know. When I go back to South Sudan, there will be a time maybe when I will scream again. You never know.
You know, you were only 17 years old when South Sudan got its independence, and since then, a lot has happened in South Sudan. I'm wondering what your advice is to the people of Zimbabwe, being a citizen of South Sudan. What would be your advice to them at this very critical moment?
Yeah, at this moment, I think the only advice probably would be like, yeah, it's time. It's like a stepping stone. They begin with this, but they shouldn't hope that everything's fine. They should now strengthen, like build on how they are going to start on from life from now. How is it going to be? So they need to also be able to, the leaders who are coming, maybe they should be able to take on the stone now. How are they going to roll it? They need to roll it the right way, which the citizens expect. So the jubilation right is there, but they need to foresee this jubilation should continue, meaning that they need to continue. Because what happens is that after jubilation, business resumed on very well today and everyone was happy in the mood. So I think they should keep that spirit, then they'll achieve what they want.
What's your advice to civil society groups and students, even amid the celebrations? What should be their focus right now?
They should be advocating for what they expect. Like if it is education, better education, which they want, these are some of the things they should be telling people who are coming in now, so that these leaders should prioritize them as they come in. Because normally that's what happens. You need to show what you wanted. So I think this is the right time to showcase so that the leaders can prioritize it. I just felt it, how it is to resolve things peacefully. Everyone enjoys. You see the happiness, no gunshot, but you see people, how people enjoy making. It's not. I'm not saying it's a revolution, but with that change, peaceful change. That's what we want in every country in Africa.
Robert Mugabe fell from power after 37 years of ruling Zimbabwe. 6 years ago, Egyptian Hosni Mubarak was forced out after 30 years in power. In both cases, succession was a major factor leading to their removal. Ahmed Fati is the managing editor of the New York-based American TV Incorporated. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi about how succession in dictatorships can be a final move toward the end.
37 years is quite a substantial, long time to rule a country. Robert Mugabe did not just rule Zimbabwe, he transformed it into a kind of a private property for him and his family. He was historical leader of independence, and he gained the independence back then. And he consolidated his power through a party, which is the ZANU-PF, but giving concessions to create small pockets of corruption throughout the country. Zimbabwe has the largest shrinking economy in the world, have an astronomical annual inflation of 221% annually. And still, he controlled the military, he controlled the judiciary, he controlled the security apparatus. All came to a point that these entities saw that it is in their benefit to force Mugabe out, especially after the army has moved and the generals have withdrawn their support from Mugabe, although they were a main tool into oppressing the Zimbabwean people.
So how would you compare the falling of Mugabe to that of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak in 2011?
The key similarity between the fall of Mugabe and the fall of Mubarak in 2011 is that family. This is the key word. Mubarak wanted to pass down the power to his son, Gamal, while Robert Mugabe wanted to pass the power to his wife and Vice President Grace. So search for the family, the two similarities are quite obvious. The other part, how the people received both the news of the resignation of Mubarak and of Mugabe. I was watching yesterday, and I said to myself, this scenes I have seen all over again, the jubilation of the population out in the street, the friendly gestures from the military towards the people of Zimbabwe. This we have all seen in Tahrir Square back in February 11, 2011. So both of them have similarities. Both of them ruled for extended period of time. Mubarak ruled for 30 years. Mugabe ruled for 37 years.
Is there a reason for the people of Zimbabwe to celebrate the departure of their dictator?
Of course, it's a big event, but what does the future hold? That's the main question. I was looking over some reports coming from Harare. It seems there is a tendency or a leniency towards forming a coalition government to take over. The ZANU-PF party have elected a new leader who was served previously as the Mugabe's vice president, Emmerson Mnangagwa. And he's trying now to reach out to the opposition leader, namely the Democratic Movement of Change. How long this outreach is going to last, how long the peace is going to last, I don't think, based on our experiences and observation in the Middle East, it's going to last for long. This can be a maneuver to absorb the anger of the street. But at the end, Mnangagwa holds a lot of power. He's a ruthless operator, same way as Mugabe. What's going for Mnangagwa a little bit further, that he's preferred by China. China is the largest investor in Zimbabwe. Whether they liked how Mugabe was running the economy or not, Mnangagwa represents for them a safer bet to protect their interests in this country.
Final question. What is the lesson to be learned from the rise and fall of both Mubarak and Mugabe?
The main lesson, I think, that it is relatively easy to remove a dictator from office, but it is an extremely difficult task to root out dictatorship from every corner in the country, since they become really deep-rooted, and they stand as an obstacle towards forming a modern and vibrant democracy.
And that was Ahmed Fati, the managing editor of the New York-based American Television Incorporated, speaking there to VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Moving to the DRC, new research by the International Rescue Committee shows the overwhelming majority of sexual violence against teens in the DRC's conflict zones happens in the home and in personal relationships. The study dispels popular beliefs about the region, often regarded as the world's rape capital. The DRC's high rape rates are commonly blamed on soldiers and rebels and seen as a result of prolonged conflict. The report says 80% of sexual violence was committed by intimate partners, friends, and family, and that violence in the home widely affects girls as young as 10. The IRC found that more than 60% of girls aged 10 to 14 survived in embattled areas of eastern and southern Congo, said they had experienced sexual, physical, and emotional violence in the past year. The agency says these abuses likely increase in conflict zones because law and order breaks down, violence becomes normalized, and women and girls are isolated from their support networks.
Sufi Muslims in Egypt say they plan to continue organizing for an annual celebration of the birthday of their Prophet Muhammad, even as the country reels from the massacre at a Sinai mosque that killed 305 worshippers and wounded another 128. No group has claimed responsibility for Friday's attack, widely believed in Egypt to have been launched because of Sufis worship at the Al-Rada Mosque in the village by the same name and are viewed as heretics by Islamic militants. The Sufis say they will mark Muhammad's birthday next Friday throughout the country and at Cairo's Al-Hussein Mosque, one of Islam's most prominent sites in Egypt. On orders from President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, Egypt is observing 3 days of mourning for the slaughter that unfolded just as an imam was about to deliver his sermon.
A student from Western Kenya is the top performer in the country's recent national primary school exams. Her success is made extraordinary because she is albino, a group that has experienced discrimination in Africa, particularly when it comes to access to education. VOA's Jill Craig has more from Nairobi.
Almost 1 million primary school children took the 2017 Kenya Certificate of Primary Education exam, known as the KCPE. Goldilin Kakuya, a girl from St. Anne's Junior School in Labau, Kakamega, received top honors, with 455 marks out of 500.
I was really happy about it. I'm excited a lot because it has passed a message to so many people. So what thrills me most is that it has opened the eyes of many people.
Goldilin's success opened the eyes of many people because she has albinism, a genetic condition that results in the skin, hair, or eyes lacking color. People with albinism often face discrimination in Africa, and children struggle with educational opportunities. Kenyan Senator Isaac Mwaura is chairman of the Albinism Society of Kenya.
People have talent, and given an opportunity, they can do so. So I would want to really say that young children with albinism across Africa, and indeed the world, because there's a lot of persecution and discrimination that is geared towards people with albinism, that they should feel encouraged that they too can reach at the top, and that families should also embrace children with albinism and also the society at large.
Goldilin's mother, Matilda Chirono Tanga, agrees that discrimination against people with albinism is common.
And because of that attitude, people will not even imagine that these children have a perfect brain. They think they cannot learn, they cannot compete. But the performance or the achievement of Goldilin has proved to the society that albinism is just a condition of the skin.
Goldilin told VOA she worked hard for her success, reviewing her many revision books, asking teachers questions in class, rarely missing her lessons, and doing quite a bit of personal study and group work. She offers these tips to other students.
Pray hard, do your best, believe in yourself, because if you're praying and you're walking towards your goal, what can deter you from that? So it's just a matter of being confident, yes.
All students who received 400 marks or more will be given admittance into the coveted national secondary schools. This year, roughly 10,000 students reached this threshold. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
For about half a century, up until 2014, Cementeries du Cameroun, a subsidiary of the Lafarge Holcim Group, monopolized Cameroon's cement market. Over that period, supply shortages were frequent and construction was forced to a standstill as builders waited weeks and months for supplies. However, a decision by the government 5 years ago to end the monopoly and allow market competition has seen Cameroon emerge as a battlefield for big cement multinationals. Ntarike Divine Jr. has more.
Over the past 3 years, the country's cement industry has witnessed a spectacular turnaround with the arrival of three new players, all foreign multinationals. Today, the essential building material is sufficiently available even in the country's remotest hinterlands, and production trends are steadily rising. Nde Ekuma is a cement distributor in Cameroon's commercial hub, Douala.
Yes, Cameroon is becoming a battleground for cement factories. The scramble, can put it, the scramble for a space in the Cameroonian market, since it's a vast construction site announced as the country intends to emerge by 2035. And you have to understand that Cameroon being the major key player in the SOP region, I think it's important for those cement factories to come up for a space in the country, especially as even the neighboring countries too are struggling to, you know, to they are constructing.
Current production, according to figures from the Ministry of Trade, stands at 4.2 million tons per year and far above the 1.6 million tons produced by Cimenterie du Cameroun when it reigned supreme and unchallenged 3 years ago. Its competitors include Ciment de l'Afrique, CIMAF, a subsidiary of Morocco's Adoha Group. It kick-started operations in 2014 at a 30 million euro worth factory in the economic capital Douala and produces 500,000 tons. Africa's leading producer Dangote Cement, which went operational in Douala in 2015, accounts for 1.5 million tons. And Medsem, a branch of Turkey's Eren Holdings, set up shop in Douala last year and yields 600,000 tons yearly. Douala-based distributor De Kuma says growing demand is a big motivator.
You should equally understand that there's a market, like I was saying, there's the market for all these products. You know, to come, don't forget, it's a very vast country, and if you have, by extension, the sub-region, it is worthwhile coming for that.
Cameroon resembles a nation under reconstruction, with several major infrastructure projects, including ports, dams, bridges, roads, football stadia, and low-cost housing ventures underway. Demand for cement, which is estimated by the Ministry of Trade at 3% per year, is projected to jump to 8% by 2020. And on the sidelines of the soaring domestic and sub-regional demand, the cement producers are all planning to produce even more. CIMAF is working to triple its Douala factory's production capacity to 1.5 million tons by 2018. Cimencam has launched construction works on its third plant near the capital Yaoundé. It will be fitted with a 500,000-ton production capacity. Meantime, Dangote Cement will begin building a $150 million unit with a 1.5 million ton capacity in Yaoundé this year. According to officials at Dangote Cement, the planned investments in Yaoundé have been inspired by the company's satisfactory performance. In less than 2 years of operations in the country, Dangote has grabbed up to 48% of market shares and still counting. For VOA News, I'm Tariq Edovine Jr. reporting from Douala, Cameroon.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please do stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News. That's coming up at 16:30 UTC.
And for all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Dan Crafton, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.